the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax. But buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to a special Christmas edition of Civitalk. Today in the studio, we have Civitas President Donald Bryson. And Brooke's here. Brooke is here as well to bring us some policy presence that we need here in the old North State. Brooke, Donald, how's it going?
I'm doing well. I'm happy to be here on Civitalk again.
Yeah, we're glad to have you here. It's been a while, but we figured, you know what? For Christmas, we were going to give you an invitation to join us.
Oh, thank you. I feel very welcome. Happy.
Can I have a raise? Okay.
That was awkward.
A little awkward. It's all right.
It's on air.
Joe, you don't have to edit that out.
Don't edit it. So we wanted to discuss Christmas policy gifts because we know that our audience is listening often to our show just to figure out what's actually happening here in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. What can they expect going forward into 2020? What do they need to be on the lookout for and things like that? But before we kick that off, let's do something fun. And I want to talk about Christmas. And, you know, things are so different nowadays because we were digital immigrants, essentially, because we grew up in an age where we actually remember a time without computers the way they are
now. I like to say early adopter, but
early adopter, sure. Digital migrants, but we're not digital natives like our kids. But I'm just wondering, if you were a child in 2019, what would you be asking for Christmas?
Oh, what would I be asking for? Oh gosh. I'm not even sure anymore. I was just thinking the other day, I would really just like a football or a basketball to throw around, or obviously not throw the basketball around, but you know what I mean. But I suppose that's 35-year-old me, which is sort of strange, I suppose, but that's what I was thinking about. I don't know. I'm sort of envious of all the cool variations of Legos that kids have now. I don't have any more. And I miss Lincoln Logs, for that matter.
Yeah, Lincoln Logs were a fun toy. I had a lot of Legos growing up, too, and I was really big into G.I. Joe. Today, I don't know. I don't think G.I. Joe's big anymore. If it is, I don't know anything about it. I think the last toys I played with were Army Ants. I don't know if anybody here remembers Army Ants, but Micro Machines and Army Ants was like the end of my era because I got into college football about like the age 10 of 11 and kind of ditched toys. But today, gosh, I don't know. I mean, if I was age appropriate, I think I would be into books. I just don't know if it would be like the digit, you know, like something on the...
Like an ebook.
Yeah, an ebook or the actual hard copy.
My nerd radar is high on this one.
Yep.
It certainly is. You guys chose basketballs and books, and I would just like the newest iPhone. I think that's what I'd want. And then maybe a year membership for Spotify. So I guess I'm the more technologically savvy out of us three. I'm just going to leave that there. But okay. All right. Let's actually focus on the substantive policy stuff.
Moving along.
Yeah, that's not saying a whole lot that she's the most tech savvy. She probably is the most tech savvy, but that's not saying a whole lot.
Yeah, you are. But Ray and I like to disconnect and get away from things. And you're like, more people, more conversations. I love people.
She's good at TikTok and Boomerang, which are important skills at Civitas.
Yes, they are.
Apparently they are.
Highly coveted skills.
Sending all that data to China.
Bob's got to shoot his baskets, and Brooke captures them all on Instagram. So if you don't follow us on Instagram, go follow Civitas.
Our handle is Civitas Institute.
Yep.
So, Donald, let's go ahead and dive into the substance here, which is our Christmas list, Civitas's Christmas list and conservative North Carolinians' Christmas list for our state going into, as we're going into 2020. What are some things you want to see happen?
Well, I thought that the discussion about Lincoln Logs and Legos was fairly substantive myself. But, you know, we are a public policy organization when we're a think tank, and we think about public policies, particularly at the state level. You know, what is Civitas's Christmas list? And I think the top of the list would have to be a fair business tax climate. I think that, you know, we've made a lot of progress over the past few years in North Carolina, particularly on the corporate income tax, and there's been a lot of conversation on the franchise tax. But there's more work to do, and I think that if we could make that more fair, by treating every business the same, that would be great. And you know, we hear an awful lot about from the other side, and from the other side, I mean the left or the progressives or whatever you want to call them, about businesses and corporations, those, you know, evil corporations, paying their fair share into the economy. Well, let's talk about what they actually do in the economy. They provide jobs, they provide benefits to employees all over the state, who are able then to buy groceries and pay for housing and pay utilities and put their kids in Little League and all that with the pay that they get from those evil corporations. And people generally on the both the left and right agree that lower tax burdens will help businesses or corporations create those jobs. The problem is that the way that we treat corporations is not the same in North Carolina. And as an example, the latest announcement from Governor Cooper came out on December 17th was that, or from Governor Cooper's Commerce Department, is that we are going to pay $12 million over the next 12 years to a small little corporation moving into RTP. You may have heard of it. It's called Microsoft. Microsoft needs $12 million from the taxpayers of North Carolina. Absolutely, because that poor tiny
really
company, they are suffering, have been for like 30 years now. I don't know how they've made it without our tax dollars.
Bill Gates is practically a pauper, I'm sure.
Basically.
Is he even there anymore?
I don't even know how he gets up in the morning. I'd be so depressed. But in that, you know, in that way, the state of North Carolina, the state government of North Carolina has made a decision, an ethical decision, that the Microsoft jobs were more important than jobs from name another company, right? And that's not really the way the economy should work, particularly a free market economy. And people who talk about unfettered capitalism, this is an example of how we do not have unfettered capitalism. It's literally the government picking winners and losers in what's going on in our state. And so Civitas, the first thing on our list would be to have a fair business tax climate by repealing the corporate income tax. We can't incentivize a tax that doesn't exist anymore. And if we think that lower tax burdens will help create jobs and ensure more prosperity for people, well, then let's just treat every business the same and get rid of the corporate income tax.
Let's camp on that for a moment, because I keep seeing these posts. I know you've seen them before too, but you see them on social media. 400 so corporations didn't pay income tax or didn't pay a tax this year in 2019 or something. And I don't know the truthful nature. They're all paying a tax of some sort, but you know, there are some states and there's some areas where they can get around corporate income taxes. So how would be a good way to kind of explain just to the average person out there, you know, what is the best way in North Carolina ultimately to create a system of fairness? I mean, when we look at it, we sometimes look, well, they have all this money, they have all this capital at their disposal. Shouldn't they pay their fair share too? I mean, what's a good way to really kind of have an equitable treatment or fairness under the law? Because we don't have that in North Carolina. You've kind of said that before, but we don't really have that at the moment. In terms of fairness amongst different groups?
Well, taxing corporations isn't really taxing people. I remember that line that came out of the 2012 presidential campaign, and you heard Mitt Romney say it several times, that corporations are people. And in that way, in terms of people coming together by right of association under the First Amendment and having a right to free speech and political speech and that sort of thing, yes, I agree that corporations can be treated that way in a political environment. But corporations are employ people, and that's the important part. And so people who talk about corporations needing to be taxed more and needing to pay their fair share, I think are fundamentally undervaluing workers. They think that for whatever reason, when corporations get a tax break, that the board of directors or the CEO are going to hoard all of that money and put it into a cave somewhere like a dragon, right? And that's not really how it works. Corporations are made profitable because their employees are productive. And the more productive their employees or the more productive employees that they have, the more profitable they will be. And so it's in their best interest to take that money and reinvest it in their own company by increasing the size of the workforce or diversifying the workforce or diversifying the company overall, but essentially reinvesting it into the economy and making it more profitable than it would have been paying into being paid into taxes. So, in that way, I think that, like I said, people who want corporations to pay more in tax money don't value the American worker in the way that, you know, someone who comes from a free market perspective actually does. On the other side, you know, people, there are sometimes corporations that don't pay corporate taxes. First off, there are five states that do not have a state corporate income tax. Of states that do have them, North Carolina has the lowest at 2.5%. Zero sounds really nice, but we have 2.5%. We were at 6.9% just back in 2013, so we've come a long way. Then there are a lot of corporations that most of their operations are in the United States, but they've decided to basically register their corporation in another country, whether that be in Ireland or Luxembourg or Switzerland or someplace like that, some low tax country. And that was a good bit of the conversation with the Trump tax cuts in 2017 about how do we repatriate some of that corporate money? How do we bring it back? And honestly, the way to make us more competitive is to have a lower tax rate, because there's no way that they want to, that those corporations, those CEOs, the boards of directors want to go to Dublin every year or go to Bern or wherever they need to go in order to fix all their corporate documents. They would rather be repatriated back to the United States. But we have such a high corporate tax rate at the federal level. And we used to have a really high one. We have a low one now, but we still have a corporate tax rate in North Carolina that we need to figure out how do we get more money invested into our country and into our state rather than trying to figure out how to tax people and prevent them from hiring people off the unemployment rolls.
Let's talk a little bit about cronyism on this front as well. So what that's something that we've written a lot about at Civitas, and I know you've mentioned the word fairness and making this a fair environment for all, and you've highlighted that corporations are comprised of people and it benefits them it behooves them to reinvest into their people and their workforce. So we can kind of see the cycle, but cronyism gets thrown into the mix. Governor Cooper and his administration have been attending these ribbon cutting ceremonies. But can you give me an example outside of Microsoft of maybe some other egregious cronyist behaviors that have happened in our state in the past year or two?
Sure. I think there is some sort of pandemic of like ribbon cutting addiction going on. And I'll continue to say that Civitas will gladly buy the governor and the General Assembly $5,000 worth of ribbon and scissors if that will help them not be so cronyistic in the way they treat corporations. But, you know, the Cooper administration has given out, I think, some of this incentive money faster than other administrations, whether they be Democrat or Republican. And this is a problem in both parties. I'm not just picking on Roy Cooper because he's a Democrat, but good gracious, he's giving away at very fast rates. If you look at Credit Suisse, which is a, you know, publicly traded Swiss-run bank, literally a Wall Street traded bank or a foreign bank, I think the deal with them that they got just a couple of years ago was $22 million over 12 years. Yeah, that's what we need. We don't have any homegrown banks that have developed in North Carolina and employed thousands of people. You know, never mind Bank of America, BB&T, Wachovia, First Citizens Bank, the Bank of Granite, you know, the Cardinal Bank, all these banks that were grown here in North Carolina. No, no, no. We're going to take taxpayer money and pay their competition to expand within the state. That's another example. There was several years ago, one U.S. for the past couple of years, but one really egregious example was several years ago when we gave millions of dollars to Google to expand in North Carolina. But what they did, instead of actually creating jobs, they created a data bank. Well, if you've ever been in these data banks, there's basically no lighting. There's basically no staff other than security because it's literally just a data bank. There's nothing to do other than if they have to replace some of the hardware within there. But no, we gave them lots of money to do that. I'm trying to think of other examples from the Cooper administration, but I do know that for the first 60 days after he vetoed the budget this year, and that was on June 28th of this year, he gave incentives away at a rate of about $1 million a day to different corporations, whether that be through the One North Carolina Fund or JDIG.
Yeah, cronyism is certainly annoying. And as just any free market organization out there, think tank, if you can't take a strong stand on this issue, then you're really not worth your medal, or you're not worth, you know, any salt in this kind of movement and this enterprise for freedom and liberty. Transitioning to education, you know, kind of echoing George W. Bush, who asked, is our children learning? You know, in North Carolina, you know, are the children learning, and what can we do, I think, to improve educational opportunities in the state? Because I just got done talking to a lot of parents really across this whole region of our state and the Raleigh area, and specifically a little more at Wake County. There's a lot of frustrations with the public schools, and obviously there's a lot of great public school teachers out there. There's a lot of great public schools just all across this state. But what are some areas that are kind of specific in ways that we can just move the needle immediately in terms of improving education and really getting more? I think the key to a lot of this are just strong families and more parental involvement, and school choice obviously allows opportunities for that. But what do you see are the kind of those pinnacle issues out there that we need to address?
Well, you know, the idea of school choice and vouchers has been around since, I think, 1953 when Milton Friedman wrote his book Right to Choose, or Free to Choose, not Right to Choose, Free to Choose. And that's where the idea of vouchers originally came from. You think back in North Carolina just 10 years ago, back to 2009, we had a cap on the number of charter schools we could have in the state. We were at 100. We couldn't have any more charter schools. We didn't have any sort of tax credit or voucher program or any sort of grants. And here we are in 2019. We now have somewhere close to 180 charter schools, I think. Across the state, we have a statewide voucher program for low-income children. We have an education savings account program for disabled children on top of a scholarship grant, which is basically a voucher program for children with disabilities as well. So we've come a long way. But what we're going to talk about at Civitas, we've been talking about it at Civitas for several years now, but much more aggressively going into 2020, and this is on our Christmas list, is let's give choices to every child in North Carolina, regardless of zip code, regardless of race, regardless of income level, whatever. Every child should have a choice. And right now, basically, the people who have universal choice are affluent families, rich families across North Carolina. If you don't like the public school that you're zoned for, well, then you have the money to move. Or, you know, maybe dad makes enough money and mom can stay home and homeschool. Or you can apply for that charter school. And if not, you can stroke a check for the private school that you want. They're the ones who have choice. But while we think that every child should be treated equally and everybody should have choice, choice programs like a universal education savings account program or a universal voucher program, either one, would actually benefit lower income and less socially mobile families around the state. And we see how much interest there is in the Opportunity Scholarship Program. There are always more applicants for that program than there is money. And we need to make sure that more people have educational freedom. I think that the conversation in North Carolina and everywhere, let's be honest, has really turned into how much do we pay our teachers and how much do we spend per pupil? And that is the wrong conversation to have about education. Is our children learning good, right? Not, and I'm saying that tongue in cheek, but can the kids read, right? That's the basic question. 10 years ago, which everybody wants to talk about pre-recession levels for education spending in North Carolina. So I suppose, 11 years ago? Yes, if adjusted inflation, adjusted spending, I'm sorry, we were spending more money, but our test scores were worse and our graduation rate was lower. So what was so special about 2008? Nobody can point that to me except that the teachers were a little happier. But if teachers are actually going to say, if you pay me more, I will teach better, well, how is that just not professional extortion? And that's where I'm a little lost, and that's where I think that the conversation has gotten lost in education in North Carolina.
So let's talk about the politics of this, because there really are a lot of politics involved in this. And you said this is something that going into 2020, we're going to even spend more time emphasizing, because we want to ensure that all children across the state actually have access to these options and choices. But on the political front, we saw this past year and the year prior, North Carolina Association of Educators leading these rallies. One was on May Day this past year, mm-hmm. had heavily socialist type branding. And then we also saw, for example, the Florida gubernatorial race, and that being a school choice that was decided by school mm-hmm. choice parents that had flipped their votes from Democrat to Republican. In North Carolina, what do you think the political landscape is, or the political tolerance for pushing for education savings accounts would be?
I think the tolerance is actually a lot higher. The conversation tends to, in the past, the left has made it a racial conversation. The problem is that that tactic no longer works for them, because there's a generational gap, particularly in the African-American community, where older African-Americans equivocate public education with baseball and apple pie and everything that is great to be American. Education is the great equalizer. The younger African-American community, people who are now young professionals, 30s, 40s, agree that education is the great equalizer. They don't believe that the public education system has worked out for them and their community and their friends they grew up with in the same way that it did for their parents and grandparents. And so they are looking for those additional options. And so you're seeing things like Florida with the governor's race with Ron DeSantis down there, and even in the governor's race in Georgia with Nathan Deal, that African Americans are breaking as traditional Democrat allies at the state level because they are in favor of school choice. We talk about the North Carolina Association of Educators, the NCAE. And I will say it on this podcast that they are an explicitly partisan organization. They are not friends of teachers. They are not friends of students. The point of everything they are trying to do is not to get a pay raise for teachers, and it's not to help children learn better. It's to consolidate power at the General Assembly. They're not trying to advocate for higher teacher pay. In fact, they came and endorsed Governor Cooper's veto of a teacher pay raise, but instead they are trying to consolidate power so that they can overturn the right to work laws in North Carolina, and they can actually become an actual labor union and consolidate even more power.
North Carolina is obviously reaching a tipping point on this issue, I think. I mean, hopefully it doesn't take decades and decades to see something like you've seen at the ballot box of Florida and other states where you just have, just results are starting to matter on this issue. And then I do think that North Carolina is going to reach a tipping point. But one of the things that I caught my eye, and I know you noticed it too on social media, but what just explain to listeners out there, because a lot of people saw it, what was the F the charter schools thing about? Because I didn't follow it real closely, but I just saw that all over social media. I know it wasn't something specific to North Carolina, but what was that about?
I've seen this in a lot of different places, and it was highlighted to me by Corey DeAngelis, who's the director of school choice at the Reason Foundation, writes for Reason magazine. You're starting to see that shirt. It's a T-shirt that shows up at all these rallies, and it shows up quite candidly at a lot of Elizabeth Warren rallies. Because Elizabeth Warren talks about how we need to end public funding, federal public funding for charter schools across the nation. We need to get rid of these charter schools and stop vouchers, stop the D.C. Opportunity Scholarship Program, which is a voucher program in Washington, D.C. I think that gets back to another problem with school choice opponents is that people are it's an exodus away from public schools. And I'm not saying that every public school is bad. I'm saying that people are seeking options. But instead of asking the question, man, why do people want to leave public schools so badly? Instead, we see this visceral, T-shirt wearing movement of F the charter schools. And how do we restrict these parents? How do we stop parents from leaving and taking their kids out of our schools? How do we restrict their freedom? How do we restrict their rights? Instead of saying, man, maybe we aren't, serving them the way they need it.
Which is an unfortunate thing because, like you talked about earlier on, this is a power grab, essentially, and whether it's the NCAE or this F the Charter School movement, and it's a distrust of parents at its core, mm-hmm. and the belief that the state or the appointed powers that were appointed by bureaucrats are better equipped to make these decisions. But we're going to actually pivot on over to our third item on this Christmas list. So would you go ahead and explain that to our audience?
Well, the third area that we have a nice Christmas wish list for is healthcare. And healthcare is exceptionally complicated. And I think we've all been baptized by fire in healthcare since the Obamacare debates in 2009, 2010. In North Carolina, it's difficult to make a lot of changes at the state level because it's so aggressively managed at the federal level. However, there are some things that states can do, and that's put in some supply-side reforms at the state level to help drive down costs. Overall, people talk about coverage. They always want to talk about insurance. But insurance would be cheaper if healthcare was cheaper, and we don't have that conversation enough. And how do you drive down prices? Well, you increase supply. It's a simple supply and demand economics 101 argument. And North Carolina is one of those states, one of those very few states that have still certificate of need laws, CON. It's a crazy law that the federal government used to have and was actually repealed in the Reagan administration back, I think, in 1983 or 1984. But some states still stick with it, like North Carolina. And so essentially, if you want to add an MRI machine or open up a psychiatric hospital or a plethora, I think it's about 27 different things that we require a certificate of need for in North Carolina, you have to go to the State Department of Health and Human Services and apply, and they will actually come out to where you want to open up your practice or expand your practice, and they will figure out if there is a need for the new service or practice that you would like to open up. And so we restrict the supply of medical care in North Carolina. And there have been some studies done by some great economists at George Mason University through the Mercatus Center who talked about how we're short about 12,000 hospital beds in North Carolina. We're short about 136 MRI machines. We all know how expensive MRIs are in several different services. Of the 27 states that actually have certificate of need laws, we have the fourth most restrictive in North Carolina. We regulate 27 different things. The only people that are ahead of us are Hawaii, Washington, D.C., and Vermont, which is not exactly great company, particularly from a free market perspective.
Well, you know, something that I just noticed when you're saying this is a crossover into what we were talking about earlier related to business fairness as well. So not only is this a healthcare issue, but there are entrepreneurs that want to begin these sort of practices. Institute for Justice is spearheading a lawsuit with Dr. Singh, who I believe is in Greensboro, who wants to provide MRI machines. So a case in point, like you pointed out, he hasn't been able to because he hasn't been granted a certificate of need. So it's creating these barriers to entry. So it's a healthcare and an economic issue as well. So I don't think enough people know about that. But what about some other healthcare reforms that we need here in the state?
Well, how do you get started on that? One thing that we do need to stop talking about is Medicaid expansion, because that will only make things worse. And that, yes, for things that we need to do, but that's one thing we need to not do is expand Medicaid in North Carolina, because not only will it increase the cost of taxpayers and probably cause taxes to go up, but it will increase the overall cost of healthcare while not delivering very good patient outcomes overall. We do need to have another conversation about the types of insurance that are available to people being able to have what are they called, plans that are not necessarily aligned with Obamacare. I can't remember what there's a term for that.
Yeah, I know. It's like the non-Cadillac plans.
Yeah, the non-Cadillac plans, but basically plans that cover catastrophic care. And let people do that. You know, there is a health insurance mandate, and we talked about the individual mandate for years with Obamacare, but there's an individual mandate in Switzerland as an example, but that is only for catastrophic care. And it actually, that drove down costs. I'm not saying we should have an individual mandate for catastrophic care, but what it did was create competition among insurance companies, where a state that was about the size of Massachusetts, and Massachusetts has four insurance companies operating in there, Switzerland now has 36, and all they can do is compete on prices and service. And so in that way, it worked. But instead, you know, we have this whole body care sort of thing that we're trying to do with Obamacare. And I remember, you know, Congresswoman Renee Elmers famously asking at some sort of, you know, committee hearing, because they're always having committee hearings in Congress, asking a man of, can you point to me a time in which a man was pregnant? Why do men have to have, you know, pregnancy services in their insurance? And, you know, there's no good answer to that, because it's just silly.
Donald obviously doesn't read the news anymore, because I see that men are pregnant all the time. So one of the things I like about Donald Trump's presidency on the healthcare side is he's trying to push a lot of transparency in terms of pricing, and Dale Falwell's talked about that some, at least with the state plan here in North Carolina. Right. That's an important issue. But let's kind of getting back to the bare bone basics. You know, you just scan Twitter or social media sometimes, and I see a lot of young, it's not just young people, but you see a lot of people saying, I want healthcare to be free. And without attacking the free notion, what's the problem of having like an NHS system like they have in whether it be Canada or the UK? Because I think that's appealing to a lot of people because they just keep seeing the price going up. What are the pitfalls of that? If you just get back to the very basics of this idea of healthcare, why is that such a trap?
Well, you know, you get to you talk about the British National Health Service, the NHS. I'll give you a perfectly British answer from Margaret Thatcher, is that the problem with socialism or social programs is that eventually you run out of other people's money. And we see a lot of things with the National Health Service or the Canadian National Health Service equivalent, where there are immense waiting lines. People who need serious care for things, I'm not talking about people waiting in lines because they have colds or the flu or something they can stay in bed for. There are people who have cancer who can't get the proper screenings that they need because they don't have all of the equipment they need. It disincentivizes doctors from actually specializing. We have the greatest healthcare system in the world in America. People come here from all over the place because we are able to provide the specialized care. There are lots of problems with healthcare in the United States, but being able to get specialized care really isn't one of those problems like we see with the National Health Service. The other problem is, and this is a terrible thing, but we've seen it happen several times, is that if it comes down to a question of resources, which it does when you get to government programs, sometimes it is easier to, or it is less expensive to offer people end-of-life care than it is to just save their life. And that is not a place that where we want the government to be making those moral decisions about what's more cost-effective for us. We want people to be able to have that relationship with their doctors and their insurance company themselves.
I think that's a good spot to wrap up, guys. I really appreciate the conversation, and we'll be focusing on a lot of these issues in 2019, so we look forward to you listening. If you have any feedback, just hit us up and always visit our website, nccivitas.org. We always have lots of content. We were the content leader in North Carolina is what I think our new tagline should be, Brooke.
I like it. You all have a wonderful Christmas, and Donald, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. See you in 2020.